Who could kill a general in his bed? CIA man.
I feel like you changed the
fucking amen.
You changed the order of the lyrics every time.
Maybe.
Yeah, why? Like
We did have perfect sync in the beginning.
We did. For CIA man, I think, right?
No. Who could kill?
Let's try one more time. You ready?
All right.
Let's just count down from 10. You ready?
Yep.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Blast 0. Off.
Okay, so that'll be easier.
Hello
trying to
and
fucking sync up with, yeah, whatever.
Barry Manilow. Hello and welcome to Timber Sycamore, Season 2, Episode 5. This is Episode 5, not Episode 6.
I can keep it's 5.5.
Five and a half.
Yeah, so this is 2.5.5.
Yeah. Where
because Michael decided he wanted to do an entire episode about the economic history of Chile and handed that off to me.
So for anyone who doesn't keep up with our
they don't
written works, I assume that a lot of the people who listen to our podcast do.
So by the time it'll be December when this episode premieres, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this piece is a couple months old by this point.
Yeah.
And nobody actually read it, it seems, based on the stats that I did, but that's okay, because I do it for love.
You also don't advertise it at all, so
yeah,
that's
I don't.
A you problem.
Well, neither do you.
It's not my job to advertise your private work.
No, it's not, but it would be nice of you.
But Haydn wrote a really great piece on El Ladrillo, and he's going to explain what that is in a second. And when we wrap up the economic section, I'm going to explain what some of the fallout was from all of this inside of the United States.
So when we talked about the Chicago Boys in episode 2, I believe, we talked a little bit about the ideological underpinning behind Operation Condor and behind neoliberalism at large, to talk about some of these developments that were taking place in Latin America, either by their implementation by genuine actors or by actors that were influenced or under the watch of foreign governments, foreign backing, foreign intelligence, foreign services, foreign universities, etc., or just like direct agents themselves. These kinds of economic programs at large throughout Latin America, we were looking at the history and development of them. So we talked a little bit about the Chicago Boys, which was a group, and when we say group, it's a little bit loose because it's not just like, you know, it's not a gang of four. It's not like five or six guys who all know each other and talk to each other regularly, but it's an entire generation, really, of Chilean economists that are coming over to the United States through a study abroad program, I guess you could call it, a partnership?
Yes.
A partnership between the Pontifical Catholic University in Santiago and the University of Chicago. Some of them also instead end up getting degrees at Harvard or Yale or Stanford, but are generally considered to be part of this group either because of the connections that they had, with the eventual positions they would come to occupy, of their relationships to one another, or through some other connection to the University of Chicago that they might have. These gentlemen were educated by the quite infamous Milton Friedman, who, if you don't know, is completely evil. I made this point to Michael because I was recently, we went to the bookstore just a few days ago where I set out to make the most sociopathic book stack I could find. One of the books that I got was Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, which is, Hayek is also an interesting figure insofar as he like has this weird marginal relation to Chile as a whole. He's part of the Austrian school, not the Chicago school, but they are closely related in terms of their unwavering, it seems, support for laissez-faire capitalism.
And based on what you've discussed about...
Yeah, so Hayek sounds half reasonable compared to Friedman, and Friedman sounds absolutely fucking evil.
Like, yeah.
That is the... Can we swear on the podcast? I forget.
Yeah.
Okay, we just can't... Okay.
And in a similar fashion, Frank Knight sounds reasonable by comparison with Milton Friedman and those who come after him.
Yeah, no. So Milton Friedman is insane because every single one of his economic policies, as they were implemented in Chile, absolutely just failed. In practically every single capacity. In some cases, they achieved the exact opposite of their goal, and we're going to talk a little bit about the actual effects that all of these had as they were implemented in Chile from the years between 1973, really up until, most generously speaking, 1985, Most estimates actually put that instead at 1981 or 82. And so the reason that they put those estimates over there is because that's when the like pure laissez-faire kind of experiment, pure monetarist experiment ends in Chile, and we'll get into some of these terms later, and some more practical like manifestations of neoliberalism start to emerge. By 1985, most of these new practical manifestations are also more or less disappeared. The government ends up renationalizing a lot of what it ended up not, like, you know, privatizing in the first place.
Right.
So, I'm not going to throw that many names out at you this time. I think we talked a little bit about, like, the actual, like, again, both in episode 2 and then in episode 2.5.0, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
Can this be episode 6?
This can be episode 6.
Okay, we're on episode 6 now, just to make it easier on me. So, again, I feel like we've talked a lot about it, the names that we've seen. So there's Sergio de Castro, there's Alberto Valdés. Again, they occupy high-level positions in the Chilean government, usually positions like Minister of Finance, Minister of Labor and Pensions, Minister of Labor as a separate position, and then Pension Superintendent, Minister of Economy, a couple different other ones as well. So, did you want to say something?
Yeah, so, in part, this is part of a concerted effort globally, not just within Latin America, in part to privatize and nationalize businesses, but also in like very specific countries where it is taking a more aggressive form alongside of Chile.
Mm-hmm.
So Japan, the LDP is formed, and a central part of their program is this austerity mindset,
mm-hmm.
Along with P2 in Italy and the entire Korean economy, kind of. Although Korea is really just like a puppet vassal for American capital at this point. So it's kind of hard to say like, oh, well, they were intentionally reforming their economy. Japan has a bit more latitude in what they do, and they tend to recruit very ideologically conservative, very ideologically neoliberal types who mirror a lot of the same things that we see in Latin America.
Right. And so we talked a little bit about the I can't remember if this was in private conversation or if we actually talked about this on the podcast. But
It gets tricky.
What?
It gets tricky,
yeah. Yeah, no, Mike likes to just burst in my room and tell me, hey, you have to read this. It's the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And then he shoves it in my face.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does that about 15 hours a day, every day. Anyways, so we talked a little bit about the, I believe it was pensions in Italy.
Yes.
And their resemblance to the pension reform system that occurred in Chile at the time, right?
Yeah, the plan for the revitalization of national democracy.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked a little bit about El Ladrillo. If you are unfamiliar, or to refresh your memory, El Ladrillo was the, after the Chicago boys went and earned degrees or whatever else, after they had studied under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, or studied in the United States at other universities, where they were developing this kind of very extreme laissez-faire economic ideology, they came back to Chile, to Santiago, sometime in the late 60s. Nobody has an official date, I don't think, on when the report is actually produced. I've seen some say that it was brought to the attention of, like, you know, officials in the Chilean government about a month before the coup actually takes place. But they identify in El Ladrillo, which I had to translate by hand because no English copy exists, 6 problems with the Chilean economy that they hope to address. And by my estimation, they end up addressing 2 of them. So the 2 that they address are named as exaggerated statism and the problem of centralization. They are ultimately aiming to what they call decentralize the Chilean economy.
Right, which we see all the time with the like finance bro type, that they have this weird obsession with decentralization, or what's the other one they say? Destabilizing?
Destabilizing. They're against big instability guys.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a weird stance to have. You're allowed to have it. I can't stop you. I just think that it's a bad one.
I will say that I have a stance that's quite similar to that, but not as far as finance and economy goes, but just like in terms of my daily life.
Everything under heaven is in chaos. The situation is perfect.
Yes, we talked about it. Holy disorder.
Yep.
It's a good thing.
But
not in this case, but, you know, in other cases. That's why we always drink on the podcast.
The idea that they scaled back the state is...
is quite ludicrous. It is they address the problem of exaggerated statism in terms of everything about the state, in terms of protecting the welfare of its citizens and in terms of like administering the country in an effective manner, is effectively eliminated. The parts about repression and about dictatorship and about the like curtailing of civil rights and human rights and labor rights, all that's kept. But that's not really their, that doesn't really seem to be their issue.
Right,
yeah. Statism in general.
Yeah, and this is also still an issue today, although more so in the, like, Murray Rothbard school of economics that descends from Hayek, rather than, like, the weird neoliberal types. They tend to at least lip service freedoms.
Yeah, they do. Hayek especially. That's why Hayek reads is like so much more. Like, again, he makes explicitly the point. And again, you can take it. You don't have to take it on face value that he's being sincere or that he has any idea what he's talking about. But he makes the explicit point that, at least in The Road to Serfdom, that any kind of that certain government interventions are not only desirable but also to some degree necessary. He does favor government intervention insofar as that intervention is undertaken to protect competition.
Right. He is not his descendants, Ludwig von Mises and Hoppe and Rothbard and all those dudes.
So, again, another point that's made in the actual text in LRGO is the ultimate problem of exaggerated statism is what they call the development of a lush bureaucracy. And what I will say about that is that when you have a dictatorship like the military junta that ruled Chile, you don't lose the concept of bureaucracy, but to some degree it is very radically simplified in the sense that everything is undertaken at gunpoint now.
Or incredibly complexified, depending on your position on the end of the gun.
I mean, instead of having some kind of, like, you know... So the idea in most... So the idea in most laissez-faire economies that are not run by insane dictators, which is to some degree a romantic idea that doesn't have a perfect manifestation, if any at all, but the idea being is that you want to incentivize the behavior. You want to incentivize the behavior that you want to see, and so that incentivization is much simpler when it is incented at the, you know, with the barrel of a gun. That's pretty simple, as opposed to, you know, other forms of incentivization, like you might, think about how much simpler it would have been if instead of having this weird, some kind of weird, like, tax thing with the drinking age, they just, threatened to send in the National Guard to any state that didn't want to. That's a lot simpler, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, the margin analysis there, like, the analysis of risk there is a lot simpler. Like, what's your cost-benefit?
The flip side of that is that the cost-benefit becomes complexified because of outside forces, right? So these policies in Chile are not popular. They have widespread resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we start looking at something like this, yes, you can send the National Guard in.
Yeah.
But
right,
MRI, who were stashing weapons for 10 years before before you took power, all of a sudden may have armed uprisings again.
I'm going to be honest, Michael. I'm just trying to do a turn of phrase here.
That's fair.
I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
We've talked about it for like 5 minutes now.
Yeah.
All right. So there are some other problems that they want to address in LRGO. One of them is low growth rate. That fails. We will get into that later. I would love to explain in full detail, but we're just going to go through it as we get through it. Shortage of productive jobs. That gets worse. Unemployment absolutely skyrockets under Pinochet as part of the anti-inflationary policies that he puts into place. Inflation gets better for a while. So a lot of the inflation that was happening in Chile at the time was to some degree, a direct result of economic warfare that was conducted against the Allende regime, which we talked about in episode 5. And so those, I think, are the, yeah, looks like these are the major problems that they are addressing in El Ejio. And so they also put forward a series of principles, a series of methods to reform the Chilean economy from its disastrous current state into a perfect free market, laissez-faire economic paradise. So, in order, these are the proposed solutions, the proposed methods that they put forward in the report that they give us. 1. Obtain a high and stable rate of economic development over time within a truly democratic regime, and that ensures the full enjoyment of civil rights by majorities and minorities alike.
I also want everything to be good and nothing to be bad.
So, which, well, it's interesting, again, that it ensures the full enjoyment of civil rights by majorities and minorities alike. I'm not even, I wouldn't even be, like, at liberty to talk about, I wouldn't even be in a good position, I mean, like, to talk about, like, the potential racial policies that took place in Chile. That would be definitely something I would defer to you on.
There was, so, I mean, Chile is not Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, they adopt a weird racialist ideology centered on the idea that the Spaniards they are descended from are not actually Spaniards. They're actually German.
Oh, yes, now I remember.
And they merged the Herren folk of the actual indigenous people of the United States, Herren folk being a German term that I'm adopting here. Master race is like the best translation we have for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like also partially the original people who everyone else splits off from and, you know, race mixes their way into oblivion or whatever the fuck they mm-hmm. think. But it's, so it's the Germans who are obviously the Herren folk of Europe, and they're the Herren folk who don't cook for guests and don't know how to make food that tastes good. That's fine. And then the Herren folk of the indigenous people in America. This is obviously an insane statement. We do not believe in any of this. I don't feel like I need to clarify that, but
this is not part of the Timber Sycamore Party line. If you want to read the Timber Sycamore Party line, you can see, you can see part of it on our website, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We get there. We get in there. All right. Are you ready for point number 2, Michael?
No.
Okay. Goal number 2, to be able to eradicate extreme poverty in Chile.
Oh, they did that. In that they eradicated all of the extremely poor people and then made new ones.
Yeah. That's true. They eradicated extreme poverty by creating a poverty that must be seen to be understood as possible.
Yeah.
All right. Number 3, guarantee equal opportunities, especially in education, so that access to it depends on the capacity and creative potential of each individual, rather than accidental factors such as wealth and culture of the family environment.
So none is technically equal.
So none is technically equal, yes. Number 4, obtain full employment through truly productive activities that contribute to national economic development. So I'm sure you stopped listening after the first 3 words there.
So,
which are obtain full employment.
So obviously that didn't work.
Yeah.
But there's also like this other argument that's being made here that it is possible to gainfully employ the entirety of the population and also have them work the fucking 120 hours a week that you were required to in Chile because your boss controls every aspect of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that if we want full employment,
mm-hmm.
right, in a functional capitalist society, like there is a necessity for unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
They are fundamentally going to alter capitalism and make it something else here. But that's only part of the issue. You would have to increase wages to the point where everyone could afford to live on a reduced hours
mm-hmm.
because to eliminate the army of the unemployed, we would be injecting so much new labor into the economy.
So I do not have the piece in front of me right now, the actual El Ejio piece, but I assume here that full employment means that it is like a fully realized productive capacity that we're talking about, not everybody has a job.
I wouldn't be sure about that because reducing unemployment numbers was huge at the time.
Yeah, that is true, but like that is again like, but again, that's typically what the term full employment means when reading these pieces, at least to my understanding.
Yeah.
Like, it is not so much a question of, you know, everybody having a job so much as, like, is the productive capacity of this particular nation being fully realized? All right. I could be wrong about that, though. Number five, obtain stability. And if I am wrong about that, tell us. Send us an email. I will ignore it, but he'll read it.
I do
and
read all...
And then he'll tell me. He will make it he'll make it very clear if I'm wrong to me.
I read all of our emails.
Yes,
I'll tweet out if you correct us.
Oh, yeah. You'll get the timber sycamore cloud if you do it.
Yep.
Number five. Obtain stability in the broad sense of the word.
That's meaningless.
Well, they clarify. Price levels and stability of economic policies. So it then defers to being meaningless again.
So the narrow meaning of the word, actually.
So the narrow meaning of the word, which is that we give one specific example and then we just double down on our... Yeah. So, again, which is funny because the single, specific material example that they give is also what allows us to say that they failed at doing that.
Yeah, they, started with navel-gazing and then moved on to sucking their own dick.
Mm-hmm. Number six. Oh, my God, this is so funny. This is so funny. Number six. Minimize economic dependence in all those aspects that have an impact on the political independence of the country. So what do you know about Chilean exports, Michael?
I know that most of their economy at the time was funded by exports.
Exports of what? I don't know if you know this. You might.
Oh, I actually probably don't.
Okay, at the time, and even this was the case in Chile up until not even the 1990s. The 1990s, again, in 1990, Pinochet he's overthrown. Or he's forced to have an election, right? He's forced to give up power, and democracy is in some form restored to Chile. So in some form.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
It's better than nothing, dude.
Yeah, we'll get to it later.
Yeah, it's better than nothing. Anyways, it's not even until I think 2004 that we start to see some kind of liberalization in terms of the Chilean economic exports. At the time. I think one of the better people to address this was Allende, but at the time Chile had copper, and to some degree today Chile still has copper, to the degree that Venezuela has oil.
Really?
Yes. Maybe not quite that.
So I knew Bolivia has lithium.
Yeah. No. Chile, I believe it's 53% of exports.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Now the other 47% is fairly diversified today. Not to the degree that a modern, fully developed nation has diversification of exports, but it's certainly better than it used to be.
Which also makes sense why a country...
During the Pinochet years, it was something 80.
Which also makes sense why ITT would be so invested in owning part of the telephone company because of the copper wiring.
What this goes to show is that all these, American profiteers are no better than just, local hood rats. They're going around and just stealing people's copper wire. That's their whole shtick.
Yeah. Yeah, it's if your junkie friend was also running your house.
Yeah, we could get jobs in the government doing that.
Stealing copper pipe?
Yeah.
I don't know that they hire people for that.
I mean, well, they did, apparently. It was very lucrative.
Well, ITT hired the government to do it.
Anyways. Okay, well, minimize economic dependence is actually very funny to me because, again, this is... So this is a failure in two different aspects. So we talked about the problem with exports. So a second problem is the amount of, heavy reliance that Chile had on import substitution. And the third is the amount of dependence that Chile had on this... sort of fictitious pie-in-the-sky idea that once we turn this place into a radical laissez-faire libertarian utopia, that foreign companies are just gonna jump at the chance to do all of their business in Chile. A lot of, they're hoping for a huge influx of, foreign capital that really just doesn't arrive. Predatory capital does arrive, but not to the degree that they were hoping to really stimulate the Chilean economy, to really revitalize it to the degree that they wanted to.
And realistically, the most predatory and most hostile capital is a smaller proportion of capital compared to bourgeois liberal capital. And yes, most of it will be more hostile in the third world.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you can't just like run death, like Coca-Cola cannot run death squads in every country.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, so again, like Chile, in order to like put forward these new plans, in order to like radically transform both the economic and political infrastructure of the country, needs to have the funding to do it. And so if they're not getting the funding from, you know, actual like capital inflow, if not getting the funding from a real stimulation of the real Chilean economy, they have to get it from somewhere. So they get it from foreign loans. They get it from a lot of foreign lending, which ends up biting them in the ass in 1981, probably to some degree in 79, because there's the oil shock, which again like kind of causes this major economic shock across the globe, and then again in 85. There are about four or five recessions in Chile between the years of 1973 and 1985, which is why I like to focus on 73 to 85 as the period to which to focus on for these policies, as opposed to the more common like 73 to 81, or some people will go 73 to 90. At the very least, we have to say that 73 to 81 and then 82 to 90 are like two distinct periods, and then for our purposes, I like to look specifically at 73 to 85.
So taking international loans is like somewhere between taking loans from a loan shark and taking loans from a payday lender, in that the interest rates are exorbitant, nobody can afford to pay them back, and if you fail to, your country will be subject to war, sanctions, and functionally have its kneecaps blown out.
All right, so we can get a little bit more into So I want to reorient from where we've been talking about a little bit and then just get a little bit into what I think is the most interesting part of the Chilean story. We've talked a little bit about the absolute failures of a lot of different Chilean economic policies, but I really wanted to get into one of the more sinister ones, which again is not necessarily a failure in terms of, in the sense that like for most of these other policies, we can look at very objective measures to determine whether they were functional or not, and to a significant degree they are not functional. But we talk a lot about the difference between what is, you know, like what we could objectively say fails based on like some given metrics that we like any reasonable person would agree is a good metric to determine, like for example, if your country is going through multiple recessions and you have a massive influx of foreign debt, we would agree like that is not being offset by anything, by practically anything at this point. We would agree that that's bad.
Yeah,
and you would not find anyone on the right, on the far left, on the moderate left, or the center that would tell you that that's not bad. I don't think.
MMT people.
Okay, well, they're not people. I reject that term.
The money sovereign can just make the debt not worth anything.
I, you know what? The money demiurge can punish me and throw me in. I don't care. I do not. I bow to no gods. No gods, no masters.
Chile was in fact a magic money tree, in the same way that the plantation and Auschwitz were a magic money tree.
You're talking bullshit right now.
No, I'm not.
You're talking bullshit. I'm talking straight shit.
Chile was a magic money tree, the same way as Auschwitz and the southern plantations.
Okay. So, but what I mean to, again, the point I'm trying to make here is that, like, I want to talk a little bit about the pension system. Because this is a little bit more of what should be, right? Like, to what degree should we, you know, guarantee that workers have something that is fair, that is just, that is, you know, fucking decent. And of course they will, you know, again, Jose Piñera is very fucking proud of the fact that he was able to privatize the entire Chilean pension system in its entirety, save for the military, who got to keep state pensions that were funded by taxes. Which is hilarious, by the way.
Just like South Carolina, cops have unions. No one else does.
Are you serious? What? Huh?
Police unions are the only major union in South Carolina. Although, shout out to Starbucks. They just unionized like two blocks away. Very proud of them.
Mike was begging me to move down here.
Well, I didn't say there were unions when you moved down here.
Well, that's fine. Well, I'm unemployed anyway, so who cares? I'm going to unionize Timber Sycamore, and then you're going to be so fucked.
That said, because we're both unemployed, please help us out and donate to our Patreon so we don't end up homeless.
Actually, why don't you just, you should just hire us. Give us jobs.
Yeah, give us jobs as editors, yeah, journalists. We'll write for you.
Anyways, where was I? Yeah, so, like, among the most influential reforms undertaken in Chile during the 1970s was, like, the end of the old, the PAYGO social security system and its replacement with this, with these compulsory private pension plans. And PAYGO is something very similar to what we have in the United States with Social Security. Like, it is a pay-as-you-go system.
Okay.
So it was taxpayer-funded, it was public. Which is how most functioning democracies tend to, like, run Social Security, speaking generally.
Right.
In a very general sense.
And it's also different from, like, a traditional meaning of pension to some extent.
To some extent, yes. Okay, so the new pension system was, so what they did was they replaced this with a number of individual firms that are called Administradoras de Fondos de Pensiones, or AFPs. AFPs are joint stock companies, and your pension is now managed through these private companies in terms of individual, they are individual capital accounts that are run through these. So when they were doing the transition, and this was part of the massive economic costs that Chile actually incurred in the transition from not even a Allende-style socialism, because that's not even the deal. Like, I don't want to push this idea that, like, you know, Allende was creating some radical communist country out of thin air, and then Pinochet came and did a radical, like, Pinochet was not just a revolution against or a counter-revolution against Allende, but, like, a radical transformation of everything that Chile had been throughout all previous administrations.
Yes.
Like, it is functionally a different country in the way that, like, Nazi Germany is functionally different from the entirety of the Weimar Republic.
Yes.
From the entirety of it. Like, that is the degree to which all of these things are being transformed. And so the pension system is, again, in order to enact this radical transformation, a lot of people, as it turns out, tend to like their pension plans when they've been paying into them for about 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
Just speaking generally. I mean, they might not think it's perfect, but if they've been paying into the system for 30 to 40 years, they tend to like it. They tend to not want to see it stripped and replaced with something completely different out of thin air, especially if they are only a few years from retirement.
Yeah, 2008.
Just from an infrastructural, like, standpoint.
Yeah.
So anybody who was part of the old pension system was allowed to keep it. They are allowed to continue using that pension system. The idea is we will eventually phase this out. What the Chilean government tried to do in order to encourage people, again, you could switch to the new system if you wanted to. Anybody who hadn't entered the labor force at this point would be forced into the new system. But effectively, if you had already paid into the old system, even for just a year, you were grandfathered in.
Lucky people.
You were allowed to continue to... So what they did, though, was that there were a significant number of Chileans who did switch to the new system. So the way that they incentivized this was to keep minimum contributions just low enough that a switch to the new system would be equivalent to an 11% increase in net wages for the person. So that's, again, you are making effectively like 10% more than you would if you switched to the new system. And so for a lot of people, especially in a country that is still, underdeveloped as Chile, this is a particularly enticing incentive. And this might also be for people who have not actually paid into this system for as long as they have. If you have paid into it for 30 or 40 years, absolutely, absolutely not. You wouldn't do it. But if you have only been in the workforce for, let's say, 5 years, and you have another 40, 50 years ahead of you, and you know that this new pension system is going to be the one that has the more robust support for it, like, you don't want to be 65 years old and one of the few guys using some legacy system that nobody uses anymore trying to get answers out of people.
Right. As the person who had to call Pennsylvania's unemployment office, mm-hmm. 57 times a day for 2 weeks straight, when the government doesn't answer your calls about something that they are supposed to provide you a service for, mm-hmm. By the end of it, you will either cry, kill yourself, or, I don't know, go postal.
So which one did you do?
Cried a lot. It was the only option I had left.
I should mention that a lot of these AFPs, I was never able to find a specific number of how many operated, I know that it starts off being somewhere between 20 to 25, or at least 20 to 25 by, like, not by the start, but, like, by, let's say, 1979, and that today about 90% of business is done by three of them. And some of the, a lot of the AFPs, usually the smaller ones, but some of the, like, more major ones back in the day were, you know, they were foreign capital firms. Some of them based in the United States. Which I just think is interesting. I just think that's interesting. Ultimately, I just think it's interesting.
So I have a note here that I forgot to read last time, which should have told me what the large export was.
Oh, go ahead.
The only American company other than ITT that actively could take efforts against Allende, because the rest of them kind of do the passive half measures thing.
Yeah, we don't want to just randomly overthrow people. We want to, you know.
We want to consciously choose who the next dictator is.
They're sitting there doing their margin analysis. They're, you know, they're waiting.
Continental Copper.
Could you repeat that for the audience one more time?
Continental Copper.
Pull that shit out, Jamie.
Oh, man. That's hilarious. I love that.
So, again, like, in doing my research for the actual piece that I wrote on collapse, and you can read that at, again, kollaps.substack.com, I had to read a lot of different, we'll call them, just very generally primary sources, in the sense that they are, a lot of them are coming from people who participated in this. Jose Pinera, in a article for the Foundation of Economic Education, he is the previous Minister of Pensions for Chile. He's the previous pension superintendent, that is. He's very proud of the fact that he privatized the pension system. I have him here quoted saying, "These contributions are invested in capital markets through private investment managers, yielding real positive rates of return. There are some interventions, including guidelines to exclude highly risky investments from pension savings accounts, but there aren't any compulsory investments, certainly not government securities." So, between 1981 and 1985, government and central bank securities as a percentage of the total holdings of pension fund portfolios increases from 21% to 42.4%. In the late 1980s, more than 90% of holdings in AFP equities portfolios are concentrated into only eight companies. All of these eight companies are formerly public utilities companies that were privatized.
Chile being the first country to ever nationalize their energy, or privatize their entire energy system, especially their oil and electric. I only found that out during the Canada thing.
What was the Canada thing?
The minister in Victoria who proposed that they provide a public option.
What happened there?
It was recent. We talked about it on Proxenos.
Was that Canada?
Or Australia.
Jesus Christ, Michael.
Sorry, I don't know my Commonwealths.
I was like, oh my God. Yeah, we talked about the Australian, the energy public option on Proxenos.
Yeah.
God, that must have been 2 months ago now.
Chile provided the first energy private option.
All right. So, the privatized pension system has been actually a... One, I do want to just reiterate that the people who are enforcing all of the new policies in Chile get to keep the old system of pensions just forever. State-funded pensions, that's the military. They get to keep the old system. Like, the oppressive Allende regime, which, again, does not even start under him. But the oppressive Allende regime's, you know, a totalitarian socialist doctrine of, pay-go social security is retained. They get to keep it. The system of privatized pension has been, like, a major source of strife for the Chilean populace. It is one of the major named factors during the protests of 2018 and 2019 in Chile, if you remember those. Again, those protests are not about one specific thing, but that is a grievance that is brought up several times.
Although a shocking number of the grievances do originate here.
Yep. What I think is really insidious is so the AFPs and the privatized pensions in Chile actually do make a reappearance in the COVID-19 era. In 2021, during the COVID-19 pandemic, the So the Chilean government, in lieu of like an economic stimulus package, like a real one, allowed pensioners to withdraw limited cash amounts from their pension plans at certain periods in time. I believe there were three. The average Chilean withdrew 40% of their account during each withdrawal period. There are certain numbers I could bring up for you. There's an article on Reuters about this if you want to go read that.
So it's like a weird version of something that America also allows, which is borrowing against your 401k. Like if you have a 401k package, you are allowed to borrow a certain amount from it and pay yourself back. There are still regulations on how fast you have to pay yourself back, or you pump up your own interest. And because, again, the bank is holding all of this money, so they are charging you interest on the money that they're not making.
Again, I think the pensions is one of the more fascinating stories that happens under Chile. We talked a little bit about, well, not strictly an economic policy, but to some degree having a significant effect on the economy, more so than, again, everything has a significant effect on the economy, but more so than anything else, I think, would be the curtailing of labor rights under Pinochet, which I think you would, we talked a little bit about that before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Namely, they pretty much all get removed.
Mm-hmm.
In much the same way that, like, P2 planned to, and in much the same way that has been done in the U.S. since Ford?
Yeah.
Nixon? Eisenhower?
And so we wanted to use this episode not just to talk about the economic policies, but you had another piece you wanted to read about the Halloween Massacre, I believe.
So, yeah. It originates with the Halloween Massacre.
What does?
During the Halloween Massacre, which is this event where there is a large overhaul of the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for this is that at the time, specifically for the CIA, the reason that this happens is because the activities that are done in Chile and Argentina get exposed.
Okay.
So November 4th, 1975, Gerald Ford is trying to address multiple top-level cabinet positions.
Mm-hmm.
Kissinger gets removed as national security advisor. He retains his post as Secretary of State and is replaced by Brent Scowcroft. Bill Colby is fired as DCI and replaced by George H.W. Bush.
Oh, Jesus. Oh.
James Schlesinger is fired as SecDef and replaced by Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's deputy is future Vice President Dick Cheney.
Nice.
And Vice President Nelson Rockefeller announces that he will not be running for Vice President again.
Why not? What's to stop him?
The right wing of the party hates him. He's part of this very old guard Rockefeller Republican. He's the last Rockefeller Republican. So that New York brand of like.
That sounds like the title of a Bertolucci movie.
Rockefeller Republicans?
No, the last Rockefeller Republican.
I can see that.
Or like a Sergio Leone, like a Once Upon a Time in America kind of thing.
So.
Starring like De Niro or something. We should make that.
Bush is presented as this outsider. He's not, but he's presented as one.
Is he presented as a Texan, even though he's from Connecticut?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I love that.
He is presented as an outsider and a Texan.
Yeah.
Which he's a little bit of both. So he's a Texan in the sense that he is part of the Republican Cowboys, as they were called at the time.
Gross.
Which is the Western New Money set. But the Western New Money set, so capital always has to build from existing capital, right?
Sure.
You can't make new insane amounts of huge wealth from nowhere.
You can try.
Well, you can, yeah.
I think some guy on the internet told me if I got my grind set up, I could do it.
Sam Bankman-Fried told me it too, so.
That joke's going to be so stale when this comes out.
Yeah, it is.
We can't joke about current events. We can't do it.
So under Bush, none of the reforms, so they present him as an outsider to the intelligence community. He's not. Bush allows everything that was already happening to continue.
Mm-hmm.
But as we discussed last time, Nixon and Kissinger were kind of trying to bring the CIA under heel, but under their heel specifically, mm-hmm. not under heel in the sense that they were going to be more regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Bush, who's old intelligence, just says, well, what happens in covert ops happens in covert ops. I don't see it. I don't know. By 77, Carter, who is very much on a platform of human rights and in the beginning seems to, for the first 8 months or so of his presidency, seems to believe that, within about 8 months he's broken. But during that time he removes Bush mm-hmm. and implements a man named Stansfield Turner, who is not a left-winger. He is not a genuine reformer. He serves for 30 years in the Navy. Serves as commander of Southern Europe NATO forces, serves as commander of multiple ships, and a carrier group at one point. He is a well-respected military official. The CIA hates him.
They hate him?
Hate him more than you could possibly fucking imagine.
Okay, wow.
So at the time...
Well, that's harsh. What did he do?
All of our military intelligence estimates were saying that the Cold War is winding down. The CIA is a Cold War agency, primarily. They are responsible for waging the Cold War. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, so they can have a budget cut now.
Oh, did that not go over well?
Stansfield Turner, in one day, fires 198 covert operations officers.
Wow, he's like the Elon Musk of the CIA. That joke will also be stale by the time this comes out.
Yeah, it will. In the first year, he fires 600 people.
I really hope Twitter is still around when this comes out.
Most of them are old guard.
Okay.
They're old OSS guys, old anti-communists, friends with Bill Colby, Bill Donovan, James Jesus Angleton, Jesse Helms, E. Howard Hunt. That's where a lot of these guys who become... The guys who were the Watergate burglars were friends with the guys who were in leadership mm-hmm. at the CIA.
Okay.
So the reasons for this is Vietnam is slowing down, which means we don't need to run covert ops there.
Mm-hmm.
Electronic surveillance has eliminated part of our need to have a spook on every corner.
Okay.
There are financial limitations that the government has to observe. And they recommend firing 600 people, or 1,200 people.
Okay, that's a lot.
Stansfield Turner fires six. So rather than being treated as if he just saved 600 jobs, he is treated as if he just axed 600 people. So he has this idea that the CIA should return to a traditional kind of espionage.
Traditional as opposed to what?
Spy games, intelligence gathering, less of the black ops, covert ops, guerrilla warfare type.
Okay, wait. So what is the classical, like...
So the classical idea of espionage was that spies are there to gather information.
Yes.
They're there to gather intelligence. That changed at some point, partially under Donovan, partially under Colby, and partially under Helms and Angleton,
mm-hmm.
Towards being geared towards this very black ops guerrilla warfare style of intelligence agency that okay. we still have today. Stansfield Turner is hated for this idea. Turns out that the guys who are running these black ops are making shit tons of money on them, as you can see on my blog.
Nice.
And they don't like being told that they can't do that anymore.
Well, necessarily. They...
So
it's the service that makes the Secret Service nervous.
Yeah. A bunch of people come out against him.
Like, publicly.
Francis J. McDonald.
This is not some kind of... They're not smoking the shit that killed Vince Foster, right? This is like they're just openly saying, yo, fuck this guy.
Yeah, Francis J. McDonald, who is the head of House Un-American Activities Committee Research mm-hmm. and a former CIA agent. Pat Buchanan. This dude named Waters, who's actively in the CIA at the time.
Okay.
Who admits that black ops are only 10% of intelligence gathering.
What's the other idea? I'm tired. I'm sorry.
Sourcing from like genuine sources, building data sheets, you know, a lot of the stuff that analysts do that actual operatives don't do.
Okay.
That's 90% of it is back end stuff. Research, development, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He then says that this 10% is the most important 10%. And that
really? Based on what?
Based on his feelings.
Okay. I mean, like, I meant more like it's most important. So what is the...
He doesn't clarify what that means.
Okay. He does. That's fine.
So Larry McDonald...
That's up for us to figure out.
Yeah, right. Larry McDonald agrees. Larry McDonald, who is the future president of the John Birch Society, dies on the Korean Air Lines flight.
I would like to get through an episode without having to hear about the John Birch Society, but
they're always relevant.
They're everywhere?
Yeah, pretty much. So this was a genuine attempt at reform, in contrast with the Bush era reforms that mostly just pushed a lot of the black ops stuff blacker.
Blacker ops.
Yeah.
Crack ops.
Yeah, more slush funds, more hidden money, more moving around in secret. Turner goes the opposite route. Turner starts making budgets public. He starts doing all of these things that they don't like. The ultimate response is that by 1979, Jimmy Carter has 100% turned around on his position on intelligence black operations.
Uh-huh. In what way?
Operation Cyclone begins under Stansfield Turner.
So Carter has come, he's come to see the light, as it were. He's in favor of black ops now.
Correct.
He sees the light, or lack thereof, rather.
Yeah.
Okay. And can I ask how all of this relates to Chile specifically?
So, in the months preceding Stanfield Turner's placement as head of DCI,
mm-hmm.
There is a mass expose of the events that happened in Chile and Argentina. This is all before Iran-Contra. It's worth remembering that, because that becomes another significant event that they managed to pawn out of the CIA.
Yeah.
We'll see that in a little bit. But among the other things that fall out from this, in the years that follow, there would be, in the 1980 Constitution, Pinochet grants himself the title of senator for life. This is the one when he's stepping down as purely a military dictator and becomes like a civil dictator as well.
Okay.
So... after this happens, there's a man who was a Spaniard who was living in Chile and was an Allende advisor. His name is Garcés.
Uh-huh.
He finds out that Spain is opening a case against Argentina as a result of 6 Spaniards that were killed in Argentina.
Okay.
He is the person who originally exposes all of Operation Condor publicly. He finds a document from a man named Scherer, who is the head of the FBI in Chile.
The head of the FBI in Chile? Like the FBI's...
FBI's regional field office, yeah.
In Chile?
Yeah. The FBI has international representatives.
Okay.
They usually work with the DEA.
Okay.
So he brings it on behalf of 7 Spanish citizens in Chile who are tortured, including himself. He links Chile and Argentina. He cites the Scherer document. Chile cites cites political officials impunity. Spain eventually rules that it is a crime against humanity. 2 men, Landau, who is a famous American lawyer, and Garcés, begin to recruit a team, which is mostly former DOJ guys who carry out cases during this time related to Letelier.
Orlando Letelier, are we back there?
Yes.
Okay.
So, with the constitutional change, he gains immunity for life. Garcon gets the arrest ordered of him while he is in England. The first call to the UK, they respond and say that they will not detain him at all unless Spain issues a formal arrest warrant. The effects of this are huge. For the first time, an allied nation of the NATO bloc has been declared a war criminal. Or a criminal against humanity.
Okay.
The arrest is carried out by Scotland Yard. The U.S. backs Chile. Yep. We issue this like half-hearted statement where we say that we support the right of human rights victims to press their cases, but we oppose influence in other countries' democracies, which is a fucking laughable statement.
We oppose what now?
Influencing other countries' democracies.
Nice.
So in June 1999, 60,000 Chilean documents are released by the CIA ultimately, and then on September 2nd, 2001, more would drop. They would all be heavily redacted. And that is most of the fallout in the United States as far as Chile goes.
Okay. So we covered quite a bit in this episode. I actually didn't even... If you want to go read the piece that I have on my Substack, it's much, much more thorough and much, much better written than I can articulate just by glancing at it occasionally here and trying to recall what I've written. And of course, Mike's Substack is very good, but if you want to find his and mine, just go to K-O-L-L-A-P-S. I feel like that's easier to spell, easier to remember. It's Collapse, like the German song.
It is also posted in the description of this episode.
It is. You will remember to do that.
I do it on every episode.
All right, bet. You do it every episode?
Yeah.
Oh. That's sweet of you. This has been...
It also has our Patreon.
Oh, shit. Well, yeah, definitely subscribe to that. All right. We're about done here. Is that right?
Yep. Thank you for everything.
This has been Timber Sycamore. I am your host, Hayden DePriest.
And I am Michael Petroselli.